This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
It's a real stain on the reputation of the United Nations.
That's VOA's Margaret Bashir talking about the latest report of abuse allegations against UN peacekeepers. Details coming up.
Also, Cameroon is cracking down on weapons proliferation as it battles two insurgencies and prepares for nationwide elections coming up. And Nigeria's army says it has rescued more than 1,000 captives of the Boko Haram militant group.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Cameroon is cracking down on weapons proliferation as it battles two insurgencies and prepares to hold important nationwide elections this year. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Owai, where the military says it discovered a large cache of illegal weapons in a warehouse near the capital.
Cameroon's military raided the warehouse April 30th after locals reported suspicious movements to and from it. Adjutant Chef Major Patrice Bella is a military official who led the operation.
Notre conteneur a été attaqué sur la plateforme par
He says five gunmen working with the armed dealers fought back but were overpowered by the military. He says they will be investigating to find out the true owners of the weapons cache and what the weapons were to be used for. Inside the warehouse, soldiers discovered 10,500 rounds of ammunition as well as an undisclosed number of explosives, guns, cutlasses and knives. So far, all those arrested are Cameroonian nationals. The location of the warehouse has sparked concern. Owai is 55 kilometers from the capital. The town hosts an international school for security forces called E-Forces that trains African militaries on peacekeeping techniques. Officials suspect the weapons came overland from neighboring countries, in particular Nigeria. However, local residents wonder how they got past police and gendarme posts around Owai. The discovery remains a hot topic of local conversation. Forty-one-year-old road engineer Joseph Mbida says he is frightened because the discovery of ammunition and weapons amassed so close to Yaoundé could mean people are planning to try to destabilize the country. He says he is counting on the military to track down those responsible. Cameroon heads to presidential, parliamentary and local council elections starting in October. Meanwhile, the country is grappling with instability in the far north, where troops continue to battle Boko Haram, and in the two English-speaking regions, the northwest and the southwest, where separatist rebels are demanding independence. In April, the government banned even the legal sale of weapons to civilians. Paul Atanganji, Minister of Territorial Administration, addressing a security meeting in Yaoundé, said there are as many as 30,000 war weapons and small arms in circulation in Cameroon.
Ça atteint des proportions inquiétantes et représente une réelle menace.
He says the use of weapons is reaching alarming proportions in Cameroon, threatening the security of everyone. He says some criminals even rent weapons to kill, steal and create disorder, and that armed gangs are now found in all major cities and towns. He says the government must control its borders and stop the sale of arms. In Cameroon, a 2016 law made the unlawful possession of a firearm punishable by a prison term of 5 to 10 days and a fine. However, the use of illegal firearms and weapons is judged by a military tribunal with the possibility of life in prison If the tribunal decides the offender meant to disrupt public order and peace. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Hawaii, Cameroon.
In the Gambia, there is a standoff between government of President Adama Barrow and some environmentalists. The Gambian police over the past few days arrested pro-environmental activists who showed up at a Chinese fish processing factory after accusing the company of polluting the environment. VOA's Pandera Mbai reports.
Gambian environmentalists say they are worried about the environmental safety standards of the Golden Lead Company, a Chinese fish processing factory in the coastal village of Gunjur. Environmentalists accuse the company of polluting the environment with toxic waste, a charge Golden Lead strongly denies. Over the past few days, the police were deployed in Gunjur to hold a protest organized by some members of the community. Superintendent David Kujabi is the spokesman of the Gambia Police Force.
All I know is that six people were arrested from Gunjur and brought over to Busubi Station, and some of them have been charged with incitement of crime. But as to what exactly happened, I am not quite certain at this moment.
Among those arrested Sunday is Lamin Jame, a Gambian-American who is in the country on vacation. Police spokesman David Kujabi says the arrests were lawful.
We are carrying out our job in accordance with what we believe is what is lawful. So we don't have fear as to how we are carrying out our job. If we believe that these people have committed an offense of any kind and then we arrest them, what we will do is investigate. If we have reason to keep them, we will keep them and take them to court. If we don't have reason to, then we will release them.
Ahmed Manjang is a Gambian environmental activist. He says the protesters tried to get a police permit before protesting at the fish factory.
But they were never issued a permit. Then they decided to take it this way. Let's write our banners and go and stand in front of Golden Lead and just display them. But they don't even have the opportunity to display their banners. So how can you charge those people with environmental crime? I don't get it.
Environmentalists and Gunjur residents have complained about waste outflows at the two-year-old Golden Lead plant for more than a year. Gambia's Information Minister Demba Ali Jao recently said the Chinese company did not pose a threat to the community of Gunjur. He says the National Environmental Agency, NEA, not only made sure that the plant properly treated waste before it was discharged into the sea, but it also took some samples of the treated waste to a Dakar lab for testing. Jao says the test results showed that the treated waste was not toxic and poses no environmental hazard to humans or wildlife. Environmentalist Ahmed Manjang disagrees. He says Golden Lead is doing more harm than good to the community.
This part of the Gambia is reserved for ecotourism. So government, what were they thinking when they are giving lands into this fish meal company? Fish meal company is one thing you can never get rid of is the smell. If you go to their regulations, it's probably one of the number one regulations. They should not be anywhere near open water bodies. So they destroy the local tourism. That sends a lot of young youths into unemployment. And you can see their frustration.
Environmentalists in Gunjur said they will continue their campaign. They are asking the government to consider relocating the fish factory to another site outside the community. For VOA Africa, this is Pandere Mbai reporting.
Nigeria's army says it has rescued more than 1,000 captives of the Boko Haram militant group. Brigadier General Texas Chukwu said today that the hostages were found in four villages in the Bama area of Borno State, which is Boko Haram's stronghold. The military says its 22nd Brigade worked with the multinational joint task force to rescue the hostages, mostly women, children, and some young men who had been forced to become fighters for the militants. The task force includes troops from Benin, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, in a combined effort to eliminate Boko Haram. The reports gave few details of the rescue. Boko Haram, a hardline Islamist group, has waged a battle for territory in northeastern Nigeria for 9 years. Thousands of people have been killed in attacks on villages, suicide bombings, and other violence. Thousands have been kidnapped, including hundreds of young women forced to marry militants.
15 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Cape Town residents have become so good at saving water that officials in the South African city have indefinitely postponed the threat of cutting off water to most of the city. But as the Cape region continues to suffer one of its worst droughts recorded, one of South Africa's foremost water managers says Capetonians should still be extremely concerned about the future. Darren Taylor takes a look at Cape Town's long water crisis in the first of a five-part series.
Civil engineer Mike Muller has managed water reserves around the world, including for the United Nations. He says changing weather patterns have made it almost impossible to even remotely forecast how much rain will fall in Cape Town within the next few months.
If the Cape Townians are lucky, they'll have what they call a terrible rainy season. It'll rain the whole winter. It'll be cold and miserable and wet, and the dams will be full.
If this happens, says Muller, the city will escape day zero. But he adds there's a much darker possibility.
They could have another year of drought. They've already had 3 years of drought. We should remember that Australia, when they got to the stage, they also thought it was over, and then it went on. They had a six-year drought.
Muller, who's also the former Director General of South Africa's Water Affairs Department, says even moderate rains should be enough to save Cape Town from a mass water cutoff during the next 6 months.
They'll get through to when the rain starts, but the real question is not do they now get through day zero, but what happens in October, which is essentially when the rains end, and they've got to decide what to do next. If I was a Capetonian, I would be very worried about whether we're ready for what could happen in October this year.
Muller says Cape Town will struggle to endure a fourth dry winter in a row. Senior city official Jean-Pierre Smith says the municipality is investing billions of rands in measures such as desalination plants and extracting groundwater to make sure that the Cape never again faces such a drastic water crisis.
When the various augmentation schemes start kicking and start yielding significant water capacity, then we will be able to be in a much less vulnerable position next year. So the real crunch is now.
Muller disagrees, saying the city's true test will arrive in the second half of this year and next year. Smith acknowledges that most of the projects designed to boost Cape Town's water reserves will be ready only at the end of 2019. Muller says the Cape's water emergency has been exacerbated by its failure to invest in critical infrastructure in the past.
They have had a bad run of luck, but I think the lesson from that is if you expose yourself, if you take risks, you are liable to be caught out. And as an operator myself, I would much rather have the security of knowing that I've got capacity in place in case of a drought rather than taking the risk.
But Cape Town's enterprise manager, Lance Kraling, says there's no way the city council could have reasonably been expected to plan for such an acute situation.
What we have been faced with here in Cape Town is a 1-in-400-year event of 3 years of consecutive drought, with the third year being the lowest rainfall in recorded history.
Nevertheless, Muller points out that as part of South Africa's Planning Commission more than a decade ago, he and his colleagues recommended that the city invest in infrastructure to recycle wastewater. Then, in 2012, the country's National Development Plan proposed several interventions to provide more water to Cape Town.
All of them are now being implemented very fast, but it's too late. The one was to divert more water from the Berg River. There's a scheme to do that being built at the moment. The other was to drill boreholes into the so-called Table Mountain Group aquifer, a very big source of groundwater. That's going to be done.
Muller's hoping that the government will build similar schemes across South Africa to ensure the nation is water secure going into the future.
It's always a challenge because it's a long-term process and people tend to focus on the short term. And by the time the short term hits them in the face, it's too late to do the long term things that should have been done couple of years before.
He says if the rest of South Africa doesn't learn from Cape Town's mistakes and successes, water shortages will become the new normal in a country that's already mostly arid. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
There has been another rash of sexual abuse allegations involving United Nations peacekeepers in Africa. A new report shows the number of accusations against the international troops is about steady over the past couple of years. Although as the UN pushes to be transparent about such incidents, there is more focus on them. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaks to our colleague Paul Alexander about the situation.
The UN's trying to be more transparent about allegations it receives from the field and from headquarters about sexual abuse and exploitation. And so they're doing quarterly reports on allegations. So for the first 3 months of this year, they've received 54 allegations that include peacekeepers and civilian staff, as well as groups that implement UN programs. And pretty much on a par with last year. It sounds a lot because it's only 3 months, but for all of 2017, they had 138 allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation. So I think if you do the math for the year, it's not a huge rise. But I think in part it's due to better reporting. If you look at the old figures, 2014, 2015, they had less than 100 cases reported for the whole year, each of those years. So I think as the UN tries to beef up its response to these sort of allegations and to confront them and to deal with them, they're having more reporting.
As I recall, there have been allegations of sexual misconduct by peacekeeping troops dating back decades.
Right. It isn't new, unfortunately, and it's a real stain on the reputation of the United Nations, and the organization is well aware of it. There are certain problems around it. There's a lot of attention put on the peacekeepers, and the numbers are starting to drop with the peacekeepers, but they are very high-profile sort of situation because they're in. You have international troops and police coming to countries that are often in conflict or post-conflict situations, and oftentimes, these troops, a lot of them are uneducated, ill-disciplined, poorly trained. You're not always getting the best troops is part of the problem. And if you think about it, the UN has 100,000 troops and police from about 120 countries working in 14 peacekeeping operations. So it's a lot of people. And in any organization, you're bound to have problems when you have that many people. That doesn't excuse it. And the UN has zero tolerance for these sort of allegations, and it is definitely trying to improve how it deals with them. So of the 54 allegations that were reported this year, only two have been verified so far. So as of now, they're all still allegations. Two have been verified, and two have been thrown out as not having any evidence to support them. But the rest are all still in very preliminary investigative stages. So I mean, a lot of times allegations are just that, allegations. But in a couple of the cases, there were two women who were impregnated. There was one girl under the age of 18 who was impregnated. In some other situations, I mean, Central African Republic is one of the places where we see a lot of these peacekeeper-type sexual abuse and exploitation cases, and they've been having problems with it since that mission started a few years ago. In fact, the head of the mission was fired in 2016, and some peacekeepers were repatriated, sent home because of all the allegations made against them. There have been paternity claims made against peacekeepers. So, it gets a lot of attention, and people are becoming much more aware of the problem. And they're trying to train and better discipline the troops and vet them more before they are deployed.
So is there anything that the UN can really do?
They had so many accusations against these particular peacekeepers that they just sent them home. And they've said that countries that have repeat problems will be banned from peacekeeping. This isn't the UN's personal army. They don't, they're not their troops. They don't work for them in that sense. Whereas the Pentagon could say to U.S. military troops, if you get in trouble, these are the consequences, and we're going to prosecute you. But the UN can't prosecute peacekeepers. And that's one of the problems it has, because it in addressing this effectively. So if a peacekeeper from, let's say, the Democratic Republic of Congo is has been accused of exploiting, let's say, a young girl under the age of 18, impregnating her, what have you, the UN can send him home. That's basically it. Or if he's raped someone. So if he's raped someone, the UN can't criminally prosecute him. They can't court-martial him, as you would in a military system. So he's sent home, and the UN follows up with the home government, and there are certain steps the troop contributing country is supposed to take. A lot of times, they don't take them. It's not a deterrent for their troops. There needs to be a lot more education, and I think that the UN is trying to work on really educating these troops before they come.
That was VOA's Paul Alexander speaking with correspondent Margaret Bashir at the United Nations.
Malawi has launched a 50-50 campaign, an initiative that advocates for equal representation of women in decision-making positions as the country prepares for the 2019 tripartite elections. The campaign is particularly aimed to encourage and support women to contest and win parliamentary and local council seats. However, political analysts say patriarchal tendencies among voters are likely to hamper the initiative. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi currently has 32 female parliamentarians out of a total of 193 legislators from 2014 elections. This is down from 43 seats during the 2009 balloting. Emma Kali is the national coordinator for the NGO Gender Coordinating Network. She says the launch of the campaign marks the beginning of a huge task needed to change community perception on women.
We have a lot of work to do in terms of convincing people that women are leaders in their own right. And I think those that are going to do campaign on the ground, they need to emphasize on the voters, because the voters have a key to success for these women.
Observers say the past 50-50 campaigns failed to achieve desired results because they left key electoral stakeholders out of the loop. Wisdom Chingwede is the communications manager for an agency that champions the campaign. He says this time it will be more inclusive.
We are currently engaging various stakeholders. Apart from NGOs, we will also be engaging political parties. But we believe leaving out political parties will be winking in the dark. We are also engaging the religious community, because we believe that the religious community in Malawi still has quite a lot of influence, much broader than probably what political parties would have.
Parliamentarian Aisha Mambo says the campaign can only be successful if it starts now. Malawi Electoral Commission is expected to launch the official campaign period 2 months before the elections in May next year.
They should help them now. They should not wait for campaign period, because for somebody to be voted into power should start now, when the campaign period is very far, so that she should be famous, should be popular in the constituencies. People should know you, and you should visit the people frequently. So visiting people, it means the resources.
Vincent Kondowe is a political scientist. He doubts the success of the campaign.
I might sound like a prophet of doom, but let's be realistic. Achieving the 50-50 campaign for the 2019 elections is being overambitious, and it is not attainable. Remember, Malawi, they are strongly held cultural beliefs and values that do not bestow leadership upon women. Now, to break these cultural traditions cannot happen within 2 years towards the election.
The Center for Civil Society Strengthening, Action Aid, and Royal Norwegian Embassy are funding the campaign. Kikan Hugen is the Norwegian ambassador to Malawi.
There will be resistance, and there will be many bottlenecks, and there will be many against the increased participation of the women, but it's a matter of time for it to manifest itself.
He says he believes that the 50-50 campaign can be successful this time, saying many African countries have managed this despite their traditional beliefs and traditional practices. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and former Prime Minister Raila Odinga have agreed to end their political animosity. A discussion on Kenyan politics on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.